Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Texas Natural Resources and Conservation Commission versus White.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles W. Rhodes will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this interlocutory appeal arises out of the denial of TNRCC's plea to the jurisdiction based on sovereign immunity for damages allegedly suffered by White in a fire occurring 6 days after TNRCC removed a pump from her property that was designed to dissipate gasoline vapors emanating from her neighbor's underground gasoline storage tanks. This case presents 3 issues of statutory construction for this court's review. The first issue is the appropriate construction of the waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims Act. Texas courts are in conflict with respect to this issue. The Court of Appeals below adopted a broad or liberal construction of the waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims Act in contravention of this Court's holdings that the Texas Tort Claims Act should only be construed to waive sovereign immunity based on clear and unambiguous language, or the decisions of other courts of appeals that sovereign immunity and the waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims Act are to be construed strictly.
Do you seem to adopt the point of view that motor-driven equipment must somehow be mobile and non-stationary?
Yes, that's one of the arguments TNRCC is asserting.
Wouldn't that require us to engraft new language onto the statute itself?
When you look at the plain meaning of the word motor in the dictionary, the definitions of motor all encompass some type of movement. And so that obviously
is there a
we
motor
admit,
in a ceiling fan?
Pardon me?
Is there a motor in a moving ceiling fan?
But I don't think you think of that as motor-driven versus...
What drives the fan?
What drives the fan?
Is there a motor in it? An electric plant, a fan that you plug into the wall?
Well, I think what the argument here is that the legislature has to waive sovereign immunity by clear and unambiguous language. And the term motor-driven equipment clearly and unambiguously doesn't include, for instance, a fan that you plug in the wall.
So give us an example of motor-driven equipment.
Motor-driven equipment would be a crane, a forklift. It's not a motor.
Why isn't that that's a vehicle?
Not according to the.
But why? In other words, I mean, my problem is that vehicle must mean something too.
Right.
Which means equipment must mean something different.
Exactly. Right.
And a crane is something that you can get in and it can be moved.
Well, if you look at the definitions
right?
of how.
Is that right? I mean, a crane can be moved.
A crane can be moved,
and
but usually.
And similarly, other kinds of heavy equipment that's used on a construction site can also be moved. So why is that? I mean, what different meaning would we give to equipment other than the fact that it's not something that moves around?
Well, the case law that's interpreted the term motor-driven vehicle, if you look, for instance, at the Brookshire versus Houston Independent School District case, to tell that motor-driven vehicle means those devices that are designed for highway travel. And they reach that conclusion based on the statutes, the other statutes the legislature has enacted defining what motor-driven vehicle means. And so therefore, they held in the Brookshire case, for instance, that a forklift was not a motor-driven vehicle, although it was motor-driven equipment. There's a similar case with respect to a crane. Now, TNRCC will admit.
But now, again, we have motor hyphen driven as a modifier to both vehicle and equipment. It doesn't say a vehicle with a motor that can be driven. It means that doesn't motor driven as a modifier mean that it's a motor that actually drives the operation of either the vehicle or the equipment, as opposed to a person driving a vehicle that has a motor.
Well, Your Honor, TNRCC will concede, this is not our best position on the merits of this case.
What we are primarily asserting this
argument with respect to is as a jurisdictional conflict. And once this court...
I understand that, but can you answer my question about that? When I read something that says motor-driven, it tells me that it's a modifier, and that means that the vehicle or the equipment is driven by a motor.
Okay.
That's what causes it to work. Which is different to me than if I were to read it, had it been written, that it is a vehicle with a motor that is driven. In other words, someone drives the vehicle and it happens to have a motor. So grammatically, if we look at those words, we have two problems. One, the use of the words vehicle and equipment. And second, we have to interpret motor-driven as a modifier. How do you interpret motor hyphen driven as a modifier.
I interpret motor hyphen driven as a modifier to require something that's driven by a motor that moves. And although I will admit, Your Honor, I can see a reasonable argument to the contrary. And the TNRCC is not dependent upon this court.
What about a lathe or a drill or an electric saw? That's a motor-driven equipment that could cause an injury, but it doesn't move as a unit.
Well, in that situation, there is some movement because somebody, when somebody's sawing or somebody's drilling, I mean, whether or not it propels itself, there is some movement there. When if you look at the definition of motor, that's usually what's involved in the motor is some type of movement. Whereas,
well, if we're getting that finite, there must be some part that moves in the pump. Otherwise, it wouldn't have to have a motor to drive it. Isn't that correct?
Well, I guess there's a part that moves in your coffee maker as well, but I wouldn't think that that's motor-driven equipment because you have to plug it in.
Well, it doesn't have a motor in a coffee maker. It does that by heat. Along without a armature, etc.
All right. Well,
I mean,
well,
that's the only
I mean, the reason the TNRCC is asserting this position is for conflict.
All of this argument just has to do with whether we have jurisdiction.
That
or
is
not.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. That's why we're asserting this argument. TNRCC
well, let's assume that because we're here in this case, we have some implication in our minds that we may have complex jurisdiction. So to get to the point of why y'all should win.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
It concerns use versus non-use, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. And the proper construction of the waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims.
Let me ask you
this question.
You obviously contend this is a non-use because they weren't using it at the time that this happened. What I'd like you to do is to explain to us how we are to conclude that consistent with Robinson and Lowe.
All right, well, Robinson and Lowe have both been limited to the situation in which equipment was provided that lacked an integral component to that equipment and therefore made the equipment unsafe. In Lowe, for instance, there was the football uniform was provided. The court held that it lacked an integral safety component in the fact that the knee brace wasn't included, or that the knee brace had been removed. In Robinson, the individual was provided with swimming attire, but that did not include a life jacket. So those two cases have subsequently been limited by this court to those types of situations.
So in both, including the life jacket case, you're saying that it involved kind of, we could say it involved a use, but it lacked an integral component.
Exactly. Well, in this case, there was no use. And if we take a look at this court's, what this court has said with respect to this language, the use has got to be property damages proximately caused by and arising from the operation or use of motor-driven equipment. And in the Lowe case, this court defined what this term means, arises from the operation or use of motor-driven equipment. And arises from requires a nexus between the injury negligently caused by the governmental employee and the operation or use of the motor-driven vehicle or motor-driven equipment. And operation refers to doing or performing a practical work. Use means to put into action or service, to employ or apply to a given purpose. Now, when the pump's been removed 6 days before the fire, it's not doing or performing any practical work.
But the argument is that once the TNRCC jumped into this and put a pump in place and then made the decision to discontinue the use of the pump, that in fact that's a misuse of the pump. That if they'd stayed away from it, it would have been okay. But you can't put a pump in, and then let's say you can't put a pump in, turn it off, and if it happens, the incident happens to happen while the pump is off, call it non-use. Because, in fact, that's a misuse because the pump should not have been shut off. And as I understand it, I think that's your opponent's argument.
Right. But I think that misses the key point of the Lolo case, which is being that the nexus has got to be between the operation or use of the equipment
Well, if the operator, if the equipment is misused because it's not turned on at the right time it's supposed to be, but it's actually in place, why isn't that a misuse?
Well, because if you look at the definitions, how is, when it's turned off and removed, how is it doing or performing a practical work? It's not. You can't say that, coming back to your plain language questions with respect to motor driven equipment. You can't plainly say that it's doing or performing a practical work when it's not there. It's gone. And it's been removed for 6 days. You can't say that it's being put into action or service when it's not there. It's
so
been gone for 6 days.
Are you saying there's a temporal requirement?
I don't think necessarily. I think the temporal aspect of it goes more to our proximate cause, which we've also argued as well, that this removal of the pump can't be the proximate cause of the damages here, because there's a temporal, is temporally, geographically, and causally distance, and I think it makes the force of our argument stronger, the fact that there was 6 days here.
But if we look at that particular argument, your question about the six-day lag time, this is here on plea to the jurisdiction, not on summary judgment. And they allege that the fact that you took the pump out, maybe it took 6 days for the gas to pool. I don't have any idea. The allegation is there that, in fact, it's the removal that allowed the gas to pool and caused the fire. Now, on summary judgment, you might be able to show that that was not the case, but what I'm concerned about is the standard that we use to review and that a trial court uses in initially considering a plea to the jurisdiction. Because on the face of the pleadings, they claim that the absence of that pump caused it. Now, isn't it a matter of fact that would have to be decided on summary judgment whether, in fact, that 6 days was so temporally removed that it couldn't have caused it, or, in fact, it was the fact that it was 6 days that caused it because it took that long for the gas to cool? So will you shift for a minute to plea to the jurisdiction and tell me how we're supposed to review
that?
Well,
plea to the jurisdiction in this situation, we're supposed to accept all of their factual allegations as true, not conclusory legal allegations, not their allegation that it was from the operation or use of motor-driven equipment, but just the factual allegations, to the extent that we have an underbrand independent school district versus blue, if there's other evidence that's been presented that's disputed, obviously that can be considered by the court as well. And in this case, we presented their responses. This is White's responses to our interrogatories with respect to how this accident occurred.
Why are we looking at interrogatories if we've got a plea of the jurisdiction which requires us to look?
We look at her factual allegations and the undisputed evidence that we presented under Bland Independent School District versus Blue. Especially in this type of case, she made conclusory legal allegations in her petition. We're on a notice petition system. We couldn't specially accept and ask for more detail, but we're trying to get what her factual allegations are so that we can establish our plea to the jurisdiction. Because there's no reason to go to trial on this case if this is what she's going to prove at trial, which, as a matter of law, is insufficient to meet the standard under the Texas Tort Claims Act. And so we asked her, what's the basis for your injury? And she says that the defendants intentionally disengaged or removed the motor from the pump system, thereby allowing and causing the vapors to migrate and congregate on and in place of store property. So she's very specific that it's the removal of the pump that she claims led to her damages.
Okay, but that doesn't get you there on causation, right?
That does not help on causation.
Right. Do you agree that based on the pleadings in this case, that as far as causation is concerned, whatever the record was on the trial court's consideration of plea to the jurisdiction, that given the standard of review, that causation doesn't get you there?
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well then explain to me how in the face of that pleading and those interrogatory answers, we applying the appropriate standard, which I'd like for you to tell us what it is, could determine that you can't get the nexus requirement.
Okay. It's a question of law, and I think I'm not sure that when you have, a summary judgment is based on the undisputed facts. We're basing this on her undisputed facts, her factual allegations, not her legal conclusions. And just as this court determined in Bosley that based on a set of undisputed facts, this standard cannot meet the proximate causation requirement, the same result is appropriate here.
Well, tell me what standard do we review the trial court's decision on the plea to the jurisdiction?
It's a de novo review, Your Honor.
All right. And when we conducted a de novo review, are we to what deference are we to give to the plaintiff's allegations and to the record with respect to its effort to show by her pleadings that jurisdiction was waived by the legislature?
Factual allegations have to be accepted as true, and undisputed evidence presented
If we look at those factual allegations, that gasoline vapors migrated and pooled in her property, therefore causing it to catch on fire, and we look at her interrogatory answers and she says that that's the case, tell me how we get there to decide that those allegations are not sufficient to meet the nexus requirement as a matter of law.
Because the proximate cause has to be from the use or the operation of the equipment.
Okay, well that's the separate issue. Did she actually allege use or operation of the equipment? Assuming that she alleged use or operation, how would you have us read this to show that she has not sufficiently pled the causation or nexus piece in order to establish waiver?
Well, because the proximate cause, if you look at the terms of the statute, the proximate cause has got to be, it's part and parcel of the same thing. The proximate cause has got to be the proximate cause to the user operation of the equipment. And once again,
you've got two separate grounds up here.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you say on the first hand it's not the user operation of equipment, and second of all, even if it were the user operation, that she hasn't met the nexus or causation, the arises from piece of it. And my question to you is separate and apart. Assuming that there is a user operation, how would we decide that pleading and the record on the plea to the jurisdiction fails to comply with the arises from language?
Well, because we're interpreting my arguments a little bit differently, Your Honor. I mean, my argument with respect to proximate cause and that arises from,
basically you're asking us to decide this on the use or non-use. You're not telling us to write an opinion that says this pleading is insufficient to show separate and apart arises from.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that there is no showing in this petition that her damages were proximately caused from the operation or use of equipment. I'm not trying to argue that as a matter of law, in this situation, a decision, that wasn't good. And there was no, I was, that was not foreseeable, there was no proximate cause there. But I'm not trying to argue that as a matter of law, if a decision to remove, like for instance the TNRCC, let's say somehow a bad decision to remove was sufficient, that would preclude the proximate cause from that decision. But the decision is not sufficient. The proximate cause has got to be shown from the operation or use.
I understand, but in every cause of action or with respect to waiver, there are elements, and each must be independently established, and courts review them independently. And so, again, I'll ask you, assuming that there is a misuse here as opposed to a non-use case, in what way does that pleading fail, separate and apart, to satisfy the arises from requirement?
Well, Your Honor, I can't answer your question any different than I already have.
Okay.
Any other questions, Mr. Rhodes? I have a question. Let's assume that a pump is a motor-driven piece of equipment, and a pump gets installed because gas is accumulating in this hole in the ground, and it poses a danger, and the pump is dissipating the gas. And then the pump, for some reason, short circuits, fails. The gas accumulates and blows up. Is that a use of equipment that would satisfy the Tort Claims Act?
I think a malfunction could be distinguishable in that type of situation from a decision to remove.
Well, then let me make it. We don't have a decision that actually removes it, but somebody, some state employee goes by and flips off the equipment. It's still there. It's not been removed. It's still there. They just turn it off, and the result is the same. The gas accumulates and blows up. How do we distinguish between equipment that is not in use because of a malfunction of equipment and equipment that's not in use by the negligent activity of an employee who accidentally
I think it goes to the definitions of operation or use in the statute. Because if it malfunctions, you could still say, even though it wasn't in service, it was being used because you were trying to employ it for a given purpose. You were trying to employ it for the purpose of dissipating these gasoline vapors. If you look at the definition of use, it's employed for a given purpose is one of the definitions. It's different when you made a decision not to use it. Because when you've made a decision not to use it, it's not being employed for a given purpose. So I can see where you could make a credible argument, and there's case law that supports this position, that the plaintiff's wife has relied on, that a malfunction could waive sovereign immunity. There's a couple of cases that have held that. And I think our situation is distinguishable from that situation.
Because it's you rely on a different provision that talks about the decision to employ it to use.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Craig Douglas will present argument to the respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Craig Douglas, and I represent respondent Tammy White. On the face of plaintiff's original petition, White has properly alleged facts that affirmatively demonstrate the trial court's jurisdiction under Texas Tort Claims Act, Section 101.021, the waiver of immunity provision.
On the face of those pleadings, there is no allegation that the actual use of this piece of equipment caused the explosion or caused the fire or caused the problem.
I disagree, Your Honor.
What you claim is that the piece of equipment was removed 6 days before the event occurred, correct?
That is correct.
And you don't claim that the actual use of the equipment caused the problem.
I disagree with that.
Okay. What are those allegations that would support that?
I'll get that. This case is here on a motion to dismiss rather than a summary judgment or after a trial. In the pleadings in paragraph 9, 10, and 11, and the 33 and 34 of the petition, we set forth as broadly as I could set forth when I was drafting the petition everything I could possibly think of that would come under this waiver provision, from digging the trench to pulling out the pump. Those specific allegations, and we enumerate each one, A through E, in paragraph 33 of the petition. But to be frank with the court, in responding to the summary judgment with one of the other defendants, we have an expert report. And I think once we get to trial, the evidence is going to be that the misuse or the wrongful or negligent use of this pump is involved in the removal of the pump. So Your Honor is correct in that sense. But the way we have it pled, there's three ways we can go with this. One, we can simply say the negligent use was the removal of the pump and stop there. Secondly, we can say from the pleadings that the methodology used by the TNRCC in removing the pump was negligent. And by that I mean maybe the week before the pump was supposed to be removed or was removed, that you only use it 10 hours a day. Then the next day, you only use it 9 hours a day, and that there is appropriate methodology used to remove the pump. Thirdly, using the pump at all may very well be the act. What this pump did is essentially suck or vacuum all of these gas fumes that are underground to this pump pipe system, and then the pump extinguished them into the air. But when you don't have a pump to do the extinguishing, you've got all of these fumes that now have been literally pulled to the building.
But you hit the key right there. You said if you don't use the pump, then you have a problem. What happened in this case is that they didn't use the pump.
They didn't use the pump on the day of the fire. That is correct.
So we're dealing with a non-use case.
Only if this court is to read into the requirements of the statute a direct causal link. Justice Owen brought up in her question that you would be rewriting the Texas law and requiring a direct relationship there, an active use or an active operation of the pump. And I don't see that in any of this court's prior.
What about the Bosley case?
Well, the Bosley case is a condition. You need more than a condition of the property to have your proximate cause. In that case, it was whether the door that was left unlocked was sufficient to prevent the suicide. And this court said it was essentially too attenuated. That you couldn't foresee that leaving this door open, you were going to have somebody commit suicide by jumping in front of a truck. Here, what's different and unique about this case, as opposed to all the other cases that I've read cited by both parties, this pump was put out there with specific purpose of protecting Ms. White and her property. The door wasn't put there in Bosley to prevent the plaintiff in that case from committing suicide by jumping in front of a truck.
Well, so, it's preventing from getting hurt.
Well, it's preventing from exiting that door. And there may be unlimited uses of that door, only one of which possibly, conceivably, would have been to prevent the suicide.
Well, let me ask you a question based on your theory, then. Assuming no pump had ever been put out there, would you have a viable claim if you simply alleged that a pump should have been put out there? The decision to not use something that should have otherwise been used would satisfy the Tort Claims Act?
Probably not. I mean, probably that's where you could draw the line in the sand.
Well, you used the example of what maybe they should have done is use the pump for 12 hours a day instead of 10 hours a day. If you allege that the pump was there, but they turned it off after 10 hours, and we believe they should have run it for 12 hours, and the fact that they chose not to use it for 2 hours, that would allege a use of the equipment.
Yes, I believe it would.
Well, so if I understand, I'm not sure if I understand your allegations correctly in follow-up to what Judge Enoch was just talking about. Is your allegation that had they never put the pump out there, the pooling would not have occurred? That it was something to do with having used the pump for a while and discontinued it, I don't know, dug trenches like you say in your pleading or whatever, that in fact compounded the problem and caused the pooling that led to the fire? I mean, do you see what I mean?
I don't understand enough about the
underlying facts of this. Is that your allegation?
I'm going to give you a typical lawyer answer either way.
Because it seems to me it makes a difference.
Yeah, and it is a difference as far as to have jurisdiction. In this case, that's correct. Factually, though, I don't know whether this fire would have happened if the TNRCC would never have been involved or not. And that's not something that's pled in the petition. However, I do know, and though it's not in the court's record, it's not in the petition, but it is in the record in the sense that it was evidence filed in response to the summary judgment of one of the other defendants, is that the TNRCC stuck its foot in the tar baby when it put the pump out there and took over the protection of Ms. White and her property. And when they did that and used a motor-driven pump, then they waived their immunity from suit.
Well, I mean, are you saying then that by having stepped in and used the pump, they caused other people not to do other... I mean, I'm still having a hard time with your theory. Are you saying then that they caused other people not to take other preventative measures that would have otherwise been taken? Or are you claiming that discontinuing the use of the pump, in fact, aggravated the circumstances so that it caused the fire? I'm trying to figure out what your connection is between having intervened and used a pump ties to this event for purposes of the waiver of immunity.
I think it's both. I think it has to be an either-or situation. Factually, the TNRCC literally came in and took control of this building, this piece of property. And I would say, as a factual matter, that we say once they've done that, they've started down that road. But also that...
So what they did, then they walked away?
Then they walked away. That's exactly right.
And so no one was doing anything about the gas at that point in time?
That's exactly right. At that point, and again, this is beyond the scope of what is pled in the petition, I'll admit that, but we're in Graham, Texas, when we have a lady who's running a Western Wear store, and she has the local fire department, the state folks come in, they drill holes in her floor, they take control, they put in a trench next to her building, they put a pump on it, and then they come out one day and say, we're taking the pump away. Now, whether we get to trial and we can prove all of these allegations, that's a different story. What we're here today is, have we pled the elements under 101.021.
They dug the trench next to her building?
That's correct. And you could find that cited to the record. It's in our summary judgment response, which is part of the court's record here.
You say that, in answer to my question, that the critical event here was the decision to use the pump. Once the decision to use the pump was made, then the failure to use it or not use it as a reasonable person would have done so creates the waiver of immunity under the Tort Claims Act.
I don't want to use the term, I'd rather use the active term, the action or the operation of that pump. Yes,
as opposed to a malfunction where everybody intends for it to be operating and it doesn't. We have an intentional decision to not operate this piece of equipment. And as opposed to not being able to sue the state because they didn't use a piece of equipment and claim a waiver, you said the critical event is once the state decides to use a piece of equipment, then whatever decision they make about continuing to operate it or to not operate it or to operate it some of the time or not some of the time is going to be subject to that type of decision is subject to a claim that can be made, and sovereign immunity is waived as to that claim.
I would think so, yes.
Let's put this in terms of a hospital. Let's suppose there's a patient who has violent tendencies. He's in a state hospital. The hospital administers through an IV a drug to calm him and then decides to remove the IV and release him. 6 days later, he murders someone. Is the decision to remove the IV, is that actionable?
That's a step farther out.
How's that different from removing the pump?
Well, here, the pump, the sole purpose of this pump was to protect Mrs. White and her property.
The sole purpose of the IV was to calm this man down so that he'd been threatening to kill his wife so that he wouldn't carry out those threats.
If that's the case, and the plaintiff in that case can plead and then subsequently establish the fact that there is a nexus there from having this use of this medicine and then preventing this murder, then sure, I think it's the exact same.
Haven't we decided that case?
I don't believe so.
Kerrville State Hospital.
Quite frankly, I'm not familiar with that. I thought I had read before this morning all of the cases. I do think, though, we can use the analogy that Justice Abbott brought up earlier with the Robinson and Lowe cases, that as in Lowe, where there's a uniform and the football player was not provided a knee brace or wasn't provided an integral portion of that knee brace, the same thing here. We have a motor-driven pump system now without the most integral portion of it, which is the pump. So I think we can get there the back door that way as well.
What about the distinction made by opposing counsel that in that case the equipment that was provided simply lacked an integral component, whereas here you lack the piece of equipment altogether?
I guess my analogy would be, or response would be, that the pump is the integral component of the pipe system which was installed in this trench along the property line, if I'm understanding the Justice's question. I would like to address another issue that was raised by Justice Baker. I don't want to just concede that this court has jurisdiction to even hear this case. The petitioner has presented two grounds to create or attempt to argue the conflict's jurisdiction. One is the standard review of the waiver provision. The other is the definition of motor-driven equipment. It is my contention, our contention, that there is no such conflict. Standard review of the waiver provision is the same, even though the appellate courts are using different terminology. It's a semantic difference only. In Guillen, the court, or the case cited by the respondent, is based on this court's decision in Satterfield and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in Whitaker. And those cases say that statutes that create liability unknown to common law are to be strictly construed. And in the court part, they go on to say it's not to be extended or applied to cases not clearly within its purview. Well, here, that's what the Fort Worth Court of Appeals has done. It says we'll interpret the statute broadly, but within reason, keeping in mind the legislature did not intend a general waiver of governmental immunity, so as to not extend or apply this to cases where it doesn't belong. Same thing. Different words, both limiting or conceding or acknowledging that the legislature wanted a limited waiver here. As far as the motor-driven equipment, again, I don't believe that the case relied upon by the petitioner is a Schaefer case out of San Antonio. I don't believe that there's a question of law material to the decision in that case that conflicts with the Fort Worth Court of Appeals decision here. That was a use case, not a motor-driven equipment case. It's factually and procedurally distinguishable from this case, as found by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals and by the Amarillo Court of Appeals in the 4DG's case. Schaefer focused on the principles and processes of direct controlling water, not on the specific elements of what motor-driven equipment is. But even if the court does find that there's sufficient conflict jurisdiction here, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals correctly utilized the standard of review, utilized the correct standard of review. They found that Ms. White there, that we had properly pled motor-driven equipment and pled causation. The standard of review issue is follows the historical construction to liberally construe the waiver provision to effectuate the promise of the purposes of the act. Look, going back to Lowe, Robinson, and Salcedo. But they're going to balance this by acknowledging the limited waiver, as Bosley required. Using this standard of review, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals correctly held that White had properly fed causation and motor-driven equipment. In the Texas Tort Claims Act, there is no specific description of what motor-driven equipment is. It's solely defined by excluding floodgates and medical equipment. But by that, it's my assertion that it recognizes the fact that you do not have to have a movable vehicle to have motor-driven equipment. There must be a separate meaning, a separate use from using motor-driven equipment and motor-driven vehicle within Section 101.021. The 4DG's case interpreted, or said that we should interpret this motor-driven equipment term broadly, and in that case they found that sanitation or sanitary sewer pumps were motor-driven equipment. The Southwestern Gas case.
Do you agree or disagree that there's cases out there that say motor-driven equipment has to be something that moves itself from one place to the other as opposed to a stationary piece that's driven by a motor?
I will concede that.
So there is a conflict on which way that ought to go, and that's raised here in our court, isn't it?
To some extent, yeah. I agree that it is.
Well, doesn't that issue apply to the piece of equipment that's involved in this case? Because it's one that has a motor that drives it, but it doesn't move anywhere. So if we decide one way or the other, that's critical to deciding the issue, one of the issues.
That's exactly right. If this court were to determine that to have a motor-driven piece of equipment, that piece of equipment must have wheels and be able to be driven, essentially, as a crane or as a dump truck or something to that effect, then we're out. You're exactly right. We lose. But that would be...
But there are cases that say that's what the law is.
But I'm not sure what those cases, and I wasn't familiar with the case cited by counsel for the petitioner, this Brookshire case. I don't believe that there's cases under this specific waiver provision. I may be wrong with that, but I didn't come up with any. The cases I came up with, and the most on-point case is the 4DG's case out of Amarillo. But to require movement, require the motor to move the equipment, I assert would be essentially rewriting the statute, which is something I would contend is best left to the legislature.
The legislature won't do it. They won't do it. We asked them 25 years ago, and they won't do it.
I understand that, and I agree, and the legislature probably can remove some of the ambiguity that's involved in this.
Well, they've not even tried in 29 years.
But I would assert, though, that their failure to act supports the earlier historical cases from this court that plaintiffs are to be entitled to a wide berth here, that they should have a liberal construction to allow people like Mrs. Hand,
the liberal conservative idea of construing statutes, it seems to me sovereign immunity is a doctrine that, if strictly applied, nobody gets to sue a state agency for anything. And so that when the legislature chooses to waive it, that whatever the circumstances, they all have to be narrowly construed to achieve that purpose. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone to all the lengths they did to write this statute the way they did and give us so many opportunities to construe it.
I agree, but the limitations on the waiver provision are the guts of the provision, that you've got to have use, that you've got to have, you know, motor-driven equipment or motor-driven vehicle. And our assertion, or my assertion, that in and of itself limits the application. I don't think any court that's ever considered this provision said that this is a blanket, wide-open immunity provision, a waiver provision. I think they all have used different terminology.
Well, but look at it from another way. Well, you know, you've got immunity from being sued without the legislature's consent, which is one part, and then you've got the immunity from liability. You could read the statute to say liberally it waives the requirement to get the legislature's consent to sue in any negligence case if it meets the specific statutes that we, a part of the statute that tells you how you can have liability. So that, yes, liberally, it waives all necessity to get consent from the legislature, but it puts you into little pockets to decide whether you can maintain that suit and get liability after that. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, and I would also say that Ms.
So then my next point is, having said that, we have to determine the nature of what motor-driven equipment is based on the conflicts between the courts of appeal, ergo we have jurisdiction.
I would say the case relied upon by the petitioner to create this jurisdiction, that the San Antonio Court of Appeals didn't come out and say that non-motor-driven, non-movable equipment driven by a motor cannot be motor-driven equipment. It's an aside if you read it in the paragraph. That is a use case, and they concede in their statement saying, well, we consider
that
still a
possibility. Well, are you saying that your case is not a use case, that it's a non-use case?
Oh, certainly this is a use case. And what I'm saying is that for jurisdictional purposes, that there is no conflict between the Fort Worth Court of Appeals here and any other court in Texas on this issue, including the Schaefer decision, because even in Schaefer, they recognize the possibility that you can have motor-driven equipment that doesn't, you can't drive.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Please support. I'd like to start off by reading what Schaefer actually held to disavow any misconceptions about the Schaefer holding. Because the status of stationary electric motor-driven pumps, which is exactly what we have at issue here, as motor-driven equipment is questionable at best, we conclude that the City Water Board's sovereign immunity has not been clearly and explicitly waived. Therefore, we conclude that the water pump in question is not motor-driven equipment under the Texas Tort Claims Act.
I think there's a clear conflict there between what constitutes whether or not stationary electric motor-driven pumps are not motor-driven equipment. And that conflict gives this court jurisdiction. And Schaefer, in making that holding, relied upon the Brookshire case that I cited before earlier, along with some other Fifth Circuit cases that held, for instance, that a crane was not a motor-driven vehicle, but was motor-driven equipment. And also, with respect to the conflict in the standard of review, opposing counsel asserts that that's merely semantics. I did a search of every case cited in both petitioner's brief and respondent's brief. Every case in which the court stated that it was going to use a broad or liberal construction of the waiver provisions of the Texas Court Claims Act, every case that said it was going to use a broad or liberal construction held that sovereign immunity had been waived in that case. On the contrary, every case that utilized either a clear and unambiguous standard or decided they were going to construe its waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims Act strictly or restrictively decided that immunity had not been waived. And
so what standard do you think we should?
I think the standard is what this court said in York and Bosley, a combination of the two tests. In York, this court said that three principles guide the construction of the waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims Act. First, that immunity is a matter to be addressed by the legislature. Second, that the legislature must waive immunity by clear and unambiguous language. And third, that the waiver provisions have to be construed to give effect to the purpose of the Texas Tort Claims Act as a whole. And then in Bosley, the court came back and specified exactly what the purpose of the Texas Tort Claims Act as a whole is. It's to provide a limited rather than an unlimited waiver of sovereign immunity. So I think the answer is that these allegations need to be reviewed to determine whether the factual allegations stated by the plaintiff clearly and unambiguously come within the limited waiver of sovereign immunity intended by the legislature in enacting the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Let's talk about the waiver of sovereign immunity. From my question, Mr. Douglas, and his answers, it seems to me one of the issues may be here that sovereign immunity is waived when the governmental entity makes a decision to use some motor-driven equipment and
Tort Claims Act strictly or restrictively decided that immunity had not been waived.
And so what standard do you think we should?
I think the standard is what this court said in York and Bosley, a combination of the two tests. In York, this court said that three principles guide the construction of the waiver provisions of the Texas Tort Claims Act. First, that immunity is a matter to be addressed by the legislature. Second, that the legislature must waive immunity by clear and unambiguous language. And third, that the waiver provisions have to be construed to give effect to the purpose of the Texas Tort Claims Act as a whole. And then in Bosley, the court came back and specified exactly what the purpose of the Texas Tort Claims Act as a whole is. It's to provide a limited rather than an unlimited waiver of sovereign immunity. So I think the answer is that these allegations need to be reviewed to determine whether the factual allegations stated by the plaintiff clearly and unambiguously come within the limited waiver of sovereign immunity intended by the legislature in enacting the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Let's talk about the waiver of sovereign immunity. From my question, Mr. Douglas, and his answers, it seems to me one of the issues may be here that sovereign immunity is waived when the governmental entity makes a decision to use some motor-driven equipment and that an injury arises out of that use. The argument is that the immunity has been waived. Now, whether how the equipment was used simply goes to the question of negligence and not to the question of whether or not immunity now gets reestablished. So the argument being the state can't be sued if they never decide to use the equipment. But once they decide to use the equipment and they implement use of the equipment, as I think as you said, employed the equipment to be used, then if they negligently turn the equipment off, that simply goes to a question of whether or not negligence occurred. That doesn't go to the question whether waiver occurred. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I think the case law on this is clear, because when we make that decision, we're no longer operating or using, as I discussed before, through the definitions. And there's also case law. For instance, a perfect example of this is the Ransom case. There's a recent en banc decision from the San Antonio Court of Appeals that this court denied the petition for review. In that case, a governmental employee was driving somebody who was mentally disabled home for the night. He stopped the car across the street from the home. So obviously, we had used and operated motor-driven equipment. He made a bad decision to drop this mentally disabled person across the street rather than taking him to the front doorstep. Our mentally disabled individual walking the street got hit, sues under the Texas Tort Claims Act. San Antonio Court of Appeals, en banc decision, said that what they're complaining about is not the operation or use of the motor-driven vehicle, but the bad decision to drop them off across the street. And there are several cases that have reached similar results, school bus cases.
But let me ask you this. Would there be use if, let's say in this particular instance, the TNRCC put the pump in play, they were using it, they made the decision that they would run it for 12 hours, shut it off for 12 hours, run it for 12 hours, shut it, or whatever. The fire occurs during the 12 hours that the pump is shut off. Is that a non-use case?
That would be a much closer question.
Well, is it a non-use case or not? Yes or no?
I would not say so, but there is authority that would say yes on that.
So your position is that that's a misuse because, in fact, they shouldn't have been turning the pump on and off and they're actually using it.
Because
so
you could argue that...
In other words, it doesn't actually require that the equipment be operating at the point in time that the injury occurs in order for there to be a use. You could have it non-operable at the moment in time of the injury and still have a use.
Because it could be non-operable and yet being used because it was being employed for a given purpose. And I can see that. But that's a distinction in our case. We don't have that.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to figure out where the line
right.
is.
Right. Okay. And that's where at least I would draw the line. Okay. I'm not...
Any other questions?
Yes, one question. If after 25 years we still don't know the answer to that question, and the San Antonio court still has to go in bank to decide these issues, should we rethink at some point the judicially created doctrine of immunity and let the legislature have another shot at this?
I'm glad to say that
you're a scholar, you're not just an advocate here.
And especially, too, considering the legislature has now created a panel to review this court's decisions and try to come up with ideas on areas that they need to correct legislation. And the Texas Tort Claims Act didn't get in there, even though this court has only mentioned it for the last 25 years. So perhaps that may be the best thing to do. But it's not ready for this case.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in the second cause, and the court will take another recess.
All right.